There's been an undeniable shadow in my life recently, an absence, a missing voice in that chorus that forms the circle of my closest friends. It's a shadow, too, that touches my work, journalism, and sometimes engulfs the mission of truth-telling that journalism at its best can bring. The best I speak of is the work of reporter Maziar Bahari. On June 21st, my friend's wife phoned me from London. She told me Maziar was reporting in Tehran for Newsweek and had been arrested at his mother's home. He'd been covering the big demonstrations that followed the contested June 12th elections. Maziar's arrest might have been foreshadowed, but that doesn't cover the enormity of his arrest. Nor does it cover all the things that happened to those of us who feel the weight and sorrow and anxiety caused by his absence. His wife is Paula Gurley. When Maziar was arrested, she announced she was in the fifth month of her first pregnancy. Instantly, an extra sense of vulnerability crept in. I met Maziar in Tehran in 1996. His worldview is both carefree and full of compassion. I've worked with him often, in Iran, Iraq, the U.S. He isn't the first friend or acquaintance who's been in a dangerous position of detention, but there's never been anybody whose face I can picture so well. The last time I saw Maziar, he was standing in my kitchen, sobbing, undone over the news of his sister's death from cancer. We lit a candle for his sister, and Maziar grabbed his bag and went out for a walk. He never came back. He'd walked to the subway, taken a train to the airport, flown to London, and on to Tehran. The next time I saw Maziar, I was in Boston's airport. There, in a newspaper on a Saturday, was a picture of the previous day's show trials. A quick internet check, and there he was, being made to say lies about his work. He looked haggard, hollow. So what is the face of a captive supposed to look like? What goes on in jail? What lies are forced into the place where truth was? Recently, for the first time, he was able to talk to Paula about the baby due in late October. One phone call. The baby, he said, helps me dream. You're listening to NPR News.
We're standing where the flags are flying. The bugles are bugling, the drums are tapping, and the people are huzzaing to watch the American jouster take up lance and sword and prove himself on the field of battle astride his thunderous steed. It's the Maryland Renaissance Fair, and we wanted to find out what valorous sentiment does lurk in the heart of the American jouster, and why would anyone do this?
I am Sir John Bashir, the Earl of Bath. And it would be my pleasure to answer any questions about the joust that you might have this day. Does it hurt? Oh, yes. Picture this, if you will. You are wearing 100 pounds of armor. Say you weigh 350 pounds at that point. You're riding a horse that weighs 1,800 to 2,200 pounds. You're riding at each other at 20 miles per hour each. You're going to hit each other with something that's about an inch and a quarter in diameter. Do the math. Even in armor, it hurts. Even through the armor, it leaves bruises. But where else can you have such fun where you can deliberately try to knock your friend off a horse?
I'm Sir William Westmoreland, Earl of Westmoreland, and royal champion to King Henry VIII. I've broken all but 7 bones in my body. Had a guy one time say, oh, you know, that's a load. And then he was a bone doctor, osteopath, and he started feeling my spine. He said, oh, my God, because I broke my neck in the same place that Christopher Reeve did, almost at the same second. I was in Texas doing a show, and I got knocked off, and I broke my neck, and it felt weird, but it didn't separate because I had my armor on.
I got to say, these make football injuries seem almost like nothing. It's incredible.
Well, the thing is, with football injuries, you're going at it and going at it and going at it. We make 6 passes and we're done. In a tournament, we only make 4 passes.
Okay, before you think we've been whisked away to some distant war zone, we should add, this was Pirate Weekend at the Maryland Renaissance Festival, a fact not exactly celebrated by knights.
It's a group of pirates demonstrating cannon fire. They didn't call fire in the hole, did they?
I bet some of your horses
didn't like that at all.
Why do people turn up at your training camp? I mean, there's a lot of things to do in this world in 2009. Why do people still want to become Renaissance Knights?
A lot of them want to escape the everyday mundane grind. You know, sitting in a cubicle, mm-hmm. you know, listening to the boss, wanting to take that boss out and hit him with a 10-foot pole. My guys get to do that. They get to come at me with 50,000 PSI of force and hit me. And what a great job for a boss. I mean, your employees are acting up. You get out there and you nail them and you have a good time. When it's all done, you know, said and done, you're friends. You can go out and have a beer with them afterwards.
Richard Alvarez joins us now from member station KQED. He's jousted for 11 years and is the director of American Jouster, a documentary. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on, Jackie.
Well, does hearing those sounds, which are so bold, bring back memories or irritate old scars?
Yeah. There is an empathetic twinge when I hear the contact hits in the background. I have to admit to that, yeah.
So jousting isn't limited to Renaissance fairs. There's tournaments too, right?
That is correct. There are independent tournaments that are held. There are Renaissance festivals that are held. And then there are stunt shows. And, of course, there are those medieval restaurants that happen every day of the week during the year.
Now, you directed a documentary about this, and you called it American Jouster. I'd like to ask a little bit about the culture of living this life.
Right.
Let's talk about your friend, Sir William Westmoreland. His real name is Roy William Cox. He's a former Marine. How did he and other people get into this? Are there a lot of former military people?
I don't know if there are a lot. I do know several of them. When I semi-retired in 97, I thought I'd never get back on a horse. And I actually got called back onto a horse in 2005 because one of my friends who is in the military got called. He had done a tour in Afghanistan, and he got called for a tour in Iraq. So I got back in harness. But there is a kind of a quasi-military camaraderie to risking your life with these guys. So I think that that aspect of camaraderie certainly appeals to the military mind.
Now, you demonstrated in your film, people live like this at least for an entire season, if not year round.
Right. If you're interested in doing this full time and you're working with one of the major companies, and there are probably four major companies that have a year-round circuit of festivals that they do, you could start in, say, Arizona or Florida in January and wind up jousting all around the country until, well, for instance, the Texas Fair outside of Houston ends this Thanksgiving. That's a pretty much a year-round occupation. You might get the Christmas season off.
Can you support yourself doing this? Can you make any money?
You can. It's not really about the money. But yeah, if you're a young man and you don't have a lot of overhead, you know, if you're not paying a mortgage or something like that, sure, yeah, it's pretty good money. You're living life on the road. You're not paying rent. You can spend your money freely. But you are sleeping typically in a tent. You know, so in that sense, it's like the medieval lifestyle. You travel from kingdom to kingdom and you joust for the king that pays you the most money. So in that sense, it really is just like it was back in the day. You know, knights would travel from tournament to tournament earning their living. That's what William Marshall, the flower of chivalry, did. He jousted well into his 70s. And what you see at a Renaissance festival is essentially the same thing. I mean, they're putting on exactly the same armor. They're getting on real live horses, and try as you might, there's no way to fake gravity. When you fall, you hit the ground. And it is a dangerous game. The actual last person killed in a tournament in modern times died in October of 2007 in England. And he died from exactly the same injury that took the life of Henry II of France, and that was a lance splinter through the eye slot and into the brain. So it's still a very dangerous game. So, yeah.
How do you decide when a squire is ready to be a knight? How were you knighted, Sir Richard?
Oh, gosh. I started jousting in the early 80s, and I was invited to join a company. And I came on board as a knight in training, and I had to learn basically to ride. I learned to ride a horse by learning to joust. And you learn by practicing the skills. You learn by lancing rings. If you can control a lance and hit a ring at a canter, then your skill with a lance is good enough that I'm going to allow you to hit my shield, because essentially my head is only a few inches from my shield. So I want to make sure that you hit the shield and not my head.
Are there any dame jousters?
Yes, of course. In fact, Roy's wife, Kate, is an accomplished, probably the best skilled female jouster, if not in the world and certainly in America. But she is very skilled, and she's in my documentary. You actually get to see her trade hits.
You know, as a matter of fact, Richard, we spoke to Kate's niece. Here's Nicole Zagraff.
I am 9.5 years old, and I am a squire for today.
And tell me your duties as a squire. You were out on the field.
I'm supposed to catch lance tips, head horses, and in the backstage before the show, I put armor on the horses and put armor on the knights.
Do you ride already?
Yes.
Yeah. Of course, riding with those big lances and those big draft horses is...
No, not yet. I wish I could, though, but not yet.
And what do you think it gives a girl to be a jouster?
Well, it's actually, there aren't many dame jousters, as they call them. It would be just a fun experience to be a dame when I get older.
Well, Sir Richard Alvarez, retired jouster and director of the documentary American Jouster, thank you for mounting up and being so gracious to us.
Thank you for having me on, Jack.
And you can find an audio slideshow of the Knights in Action and a link to Richard Alvarez's documentary on our website, npr.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. Scott Simon returns next week. I'm Jackie Leiden. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Jackie Leiden. A man, a public toilet, a bus station, and a promise. These are the opening elements of Victor Lavelle's new novel, Big Machine. Some people say that Lavelle writes like Thomas Pynchon, others like Ralph Ellison. We can come back to that later, but for the moment, the protagonist of Big Machine has a problem. Victor Lavelle, what would that problem be?
He has a number of problems. One of them is that he's working as a janitor at a bus station in Utica, New York, and doing his best to get off heroin.
Tell us a little bit more about your protagonist, Ricky Rice. He's got a lot going on. You mentioned his heroin addiction, which isn't very far in his past. He's also the survivor of a death cult and now part of a paranormal investigation squad.
Yes, so as you can guess, average everyday guy. but he's left a lot of horrific things in his past. And when we meet him at the beginning of the novel working at this bus station, it's not that this is where he really wants to be, but this is where he can end up, and he thinks, hide from the world and hide from all the things he's done to people and that people have done to him.
So he's mopping floors and he gets a mysterious note.
Yes, that makes mention of a promise he made 3 years earlier in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And as soon as he gets that note, he realizes all the things he's been trying to hide from, he can't hide from.
Can we talk about what Ricky Rice has promised?
Ricky Rice has promised to be brave. And the reason that matters so much to him is because the secrets that he has in his past are about the ways he's failed people he loved very dearly, both when he was a child and in his 20s when he was with a woman that he loved and they were going to have a child. And in each case, he fell short of what he thought he should have done for them, and he promised he would do better the next time. But secretly, he was kind of hoping he would never be asked.
So would you read a little bit from your book, Big Machine, for us, please?
Of course. But where was I going? Burlington, Vermont? What kind of black man accepts an unsigned invitation to the whitest state there is? There'd been that sting on television where police told deadbeat dads they'd won the lottery and arrested the guys when they showed up to collect? Maybe that's what this ticket was about. I wasn't a father to anyone, but I'd sure made some bad plays in my life. I wondered if I had any open warrants floating around, or could something good be waiting for me there?
I want to say that this novel is very, very funny, very darkly comic, yet we have to get him to Vermont and talk about the Washburn Library, which sounds sort of like the arts colony from hell.
Yeah. yes, it's very funny. People have been trying to guess what I based the Washburn Library, which is the place where Ricky goes when he gets this mysterious note in this bus ticket. And when he gets there, he discovers it's this secret society of, as is intimated there, black people living in northeastern Vermont, which is, of course, where black people always go to start secret societies. And when he gets there, he discovers that what he thinks is the end of the mystery is actually the beginning of a deeper and deeper mystery.
I just want to say, book blurbs are one thing, but you've got a lot of love notes on the back of this one.
Yes, it's true.
Mos Def, Amy Bloom. People call you a sort of literary mashup artist, and you yourself say that your obsessions are horror, religion, and mental illness.
I would say that, number one, all the blurbs on the back of they, and the reviews that have come through, too, by and large, have been amazingly positive and amazingly loving, as you said. And I think that sometimes what gets people excited is when they see things on the page that they didn't expect to see on the page. What I hope is they're excited by this whole secret society idea and Ricky Rice being hopefully a funny and charming narrator. But then maybe the surprise also comes in when there are serious concerns about things like faith and religion and patriotism also mashed in there together. And the surprise makes people feel more excited about the book.
It's a great surprise. I won't give it away. But I would ask something a little more personal, if I might. I gathered that this rather wonderfully fractive way that you write and free associate has a little traction from an experience in your own life.
Yes, I would say that the kernel of the book, when I began writing the book a couple years back, I'd been reading a lot of Raymond Chandler. And the first thing I wanted to write was this West Coast, East Coast detective novel where Ricky, it was always Ricky and it was always this secret society. But this other element that kept coming into the book, no matter how many times I revised it, was this question of parentage and having children. And finally, at a certain point, I had to admit that the kernel of the book, the heart of the book, was really an ex-girlfriend and I having had a relationship, that relationship going badly and ending, but even after it ended, finding out that she was pregnant and facing the decision of what to do about that pregnancy when the two of us were, to say the least, not close. So together we made the choice to have an abortion, and I was a little surprised, or a lot surprised, that as time went by, even after we'd split up, the choice to do that stayed with me month after month, year after year. It remained a concern of mine, a question I continued to have. Did we do the right thing? Did I make this choice out of fear or out of courage? Why did I do the things I'd done? I really wanted to write about that, and I felt like, frankly, by and large, I don't really see very many books by men where they try to tackle the question of parentage, abortion, choice in a way that isn't about telling the woman what to do with her body, but is instead about a man thinking about what he's done and what choices he's made.
Yeah. Yours is such an original voice. I just have to ask, Ricky Rice, Richard Wright, Black Boy, Native Son, or am I wrong?
I wish that I had thought that far ahead. Sadly, I just thought, like, Ricky Rice sounded like the kind of name of a guy who had a little swagger. And that's what I liked.
He also says, I don't have much faith in institutions, but I still believe in people. And I really heard a lot of humanity in that.
I'm very happy you felt that way. The other thing that was a little bit of a leap for me from my previous two books was I actually wanted to write a book that was full of qualified optimism. And I felt, frankly, like a lot of times with literary-ish fiction, everyone thinks like, well, it's not literary fiction if everyone's not dead at the end or something. And feeling like I wanted to write one where you could say, no, at the end, actually, people are a little bit beaten, a little bit bruised, but they're hopeful. And have that be a stand-in not only for the reader, but for, you know, frankly, for the whole country, maybe.
And you pulled in so much of America here. Polk County, Wisconsin, Utica, New York, Troy, New York, Cedar Rapids, Oakland. It's a road book, but it's not. It's a mystery, but it's not. What do you call it?
I called it the wildest book you're going to read this year. That's what I'm going to call it.
And I'm not going to gainsay that. Victor Lavelle, he's the author of Big Machine. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
The economy got some bad news yesterday. The Labor Department said that unemployment rose to 9.8% in September. That's worse than expected, and it suggests the road to recovery may be longer than many economists thought. NPR's Chris Arnold reports.
Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke recently said that the recession is likely over, but he cautioned that it's not going to feel like that to many Americans for a while. And this latest jobs report proves that. 15 million Americans are now out of work. One in six people are underemployed, and it doesn't look like that's going to get better anytime soon.
What's troubling about this report is that the forward-looking information is not healthy or positive.
David Kotak is chief investment officer at Cumberland Advisors. He says, for example, many people are working fewer hours a week, which suggests that companies are not going to start hiring much yet if they can just give their current workers more hours. Also, he says more people are discouraged and not even looking for work. All of this is bound to be a drag on consumer spending, the housing market, the whole economy.
When it comes to this economic recovery, it is going to be slow. The growth rates will be tepid. And the workout in the labor side, job side, is going to take years and years. And that is likely to be the case right through to the next presidential election.
President Obama said yesterday that employment is often the last thing to come back after a recession. But the president said he is exploring additional measures to promote job creation.
And I want to let every single American know that I will not let up until those who are seeking work can find work.
Meanwhile, David Kotak says this disappointing jobs report makes economists worry at least a little bit more that the economic recovery might fizzle. This is the fear of the so-called W-shaped recession, where things start to turn up but then go down again into a second dip.
If we had a couple more months like this, then the answer would be yes, we're headed into the W. The dreaded W is happening.
Still, on the brighter side, the pace of job losses is slowing. Stuart Hoffman is chief economist of PNC Financial Services Group. He says lately the economy's been losing around 250,000 jobs a month. That's bad, but much less bad than earlier this year.
In the second quarter, it was about 450,000 jobs per month. And in the awful, awful first quarter, the opening quarter of this year, we were losing over 700,000 jobs per month.
Hoffman's more optimistic than some. He thinks we'll start to see some job gains early next year. Also, his bank just completed a survey of small business owners. Only half as many are expecting layoffs as compared to 6 months ago, and they're getting a bit more confident about the future.
And I tell you, last month we had a terrific month.
That's Dieter Weissenrieder, the founder of Weiss Aug Inc., a metal parts manufacturing company in New Jersey. The company makes parts for medical devices, including certain types of syringes. Earlier this year, the company had some layoffs, but things are looking better now.
I hate to say that, but the swine flu has definitely helped us.
But Weissenrieder says he's also seeing business pick up from lots of different sources. He says car manufacturers, electronics companies, and others have new products that they've developed during the recession, but that got put on the shelf until the economy started to look better.
You're starting to see some of that get made now? Or?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, that's the new work that I'm seeing right now.
Other business owners aren't so optimistic, but everyone's watching the data to see what course the economy is charting on this slow journey towards a recovery. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
As we heard a few minutes ago, Afghanistan is now front and center on the agenda at the White House, but so is Iran and a potential breakthrough in negotiations with that country. For a deeper look at this week's headlines, we're joined by James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic, and our regular news analyst. Jim, good to have you here.
Greetings, Guy.
Jim, as we heard from Ambassador Peter Galbraith and Jack Keane, General Jack Keane, it seems the president has two very clear options in Afghanistan, and both are fraught politically, either escalate or scale down. For the president now, is this a domestic battle?
It is that, among other things. We heard some of the reasons why this is such a complicated choice for the president. These are the kinds of decisions that do get to a president. I think what's interesting here as he makes this choice is to compare it with a couple of similar big decisions that presidents had to make. The one the Bush administration made in going into Iraq in the first place, and of course the often made comparison with Vietnam under the Kennedy and Johnson administrations. And if we look back on the Iraq decision, the initial one, the main critique is there was not enough sort of full fleshing out and arguing of all the options and the pros and cons. If we go back to Vietnam, the main problem was a series of daily decisions, which amounted to one big decision at the end. And I think the Obama administration, to its credit, and as General David Petraeus, the Central Command commander, said this week at a conference in Washington, it's trying to have a very formal airing of what are all the pros, what are all the cons. There's going to be no easy or clear decision, no easy win, but at least they're trying to air it all out now.
And General Petraeus is speaking at a conference sponsored by The Atlantic this week. Was there any indication there, Jim, or from your perspective, that it's somewhat unusual for the generals to be so vocal and public in what their position is?
It is unusual, but the evidence, at least as coming from General Petraeus, was that the contrast between what the president seems to be saying and what General McChrystal certainly said last week in London was a misunderstanding as opposed to insubordination or lobbying. That is, General Petraeus, who is the superior to General McChrystal and the one who's supposed to be dealing with the president, both didn't reprimand General McChrystal explicitly, and when asked
asked the same question that had provoked this answer from General McChrystal, could you do with fewer troops? He essentially said, we'll do what the president decides. This is the president's decision finally to make.
But still a lot of pressure on him either way.
Of course.
Moving on to another foreign policy challenge for the White House, the administration may have scored a temporary diplomatic victory this week when Iran agreed to ship some of its uranium overseas for processing. But the White House is also being cautious about this, worried that Iran may be playing a waiting game.
Sure. And any sane foreign policy advisor would be cautious in anything involving Iran and its nuclear plan, since there have been so many deceptions and so many surprises. But what I think is really interesting is that until the electoral disruptions in Iran this summer, there was a sense by most foreign countries that each day brought Iran closer to, you know, potential nuclear power. And now there's a sense that time is working against the Ahmadinejad regime. And so if the outside world can sort of maintain pressure and scrutiny, then time may be on the non-Iranian side now. Mm.
Jim, I was looking at The Economist magazine this week, and the headline reads, After the Storm. It shows a battered worker climbing out of a manhole onto this barren desert landscape. We keep hearing good news about economic growth in this country, but numbers out yesterday show unemployment here in the U.S. reaching staggering levels.
You know, the problem with the current American economic situation is that even as the economy and the stock market recover, almost everybody agrees it's going to be a long time, perhaps years, before there's powerful net job creation in the U.S. Everybody has known this in theory, but to see it happening so vividly now is obviously difficult. This last week, I heard Larry Summers, the head of the President's Economic Advisory Board, talking about sort of restating the case that the stimulus plan needed both to create more jobs and to do it in ways that would have long-term investment rewards for the nation, things analogous to the interstate highway system built 50 years ago. And these would mainly be in the sort of clean energy and telecom network sense.
And could that happen?
Well, certainly that's the administration's argument. And I guess when they have time to focus on that issue as opposed to the other 15 ones they're dealing with, that's we'll hear the case.
This week, the president lent his star power to promoting Chicago's Olympic bid. He went to Copenhagen to make the case. Of course, the Olympics went to Rio. This is being called a setback for the president, is it?
I think a month from now or 3 years from now or 9 years from now when these Olympics happen or whenever it is, nobody's going to remember what the other candidate cities were. I think the president was in a sort of a bind. If he didn't go and Rio won, as it should have anyway, he would have been blamed for not being American enough to try. And he went, and so now he's a loser. But I think this will wash away.
And maybe not such bad news for Chicago as you experienced in Beijing.
Yes, having lived through the buildup to the Beijing Olympics, I say, Chicago, count your blessings.
Finally, Jim, to China, where you lived for 3 years. This week, that country celebrated the 60th anniversary of the Communist Revolution. For a country with so much glitz and wealth, the official celebrations looked a very Stalinist retro, from my perspective.
They did. And the first half of the multi-hour parade was every new missile, every new tank, every new regiment of mini-skirted, goose-stepping female soldiers. It was really something. And then they shifted to something like a Mardi Gras parade. And so it was a combination of all the different elements that make up modern China.
That's James Fallows. He's the national correspondent for The Atlantic and our news analyst. Jim, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Guy.